Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening. This is Joshua David Stein. You're listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour half hour on Super Bowl Sunday. Thank you for joining us. Today's edition is dedicated to the pleasures of the American diner. I review movies for Eater.com, which is a website, and this week they're having a classics week. They asked me to review a classic film, and so the film I picked was American Graffiti. I hope everyone knows that. It's a George Lucas film released in 1973, shot in 1973, but set in 1959 in California, where George Lucas is from. And most of the action revolves around a diner called Mel's Drive-In Burger City. Burger City is a subtitle. So I watched the film, and the thing that really struck me, and then I thought about how the diner played in other film contexts, is how constant the presence is and how open-ended the environment is of an American diner, and how in films that really lends itself to the diner being a cornerstone of American cinema. This is one of the things I wrote. I wrote, before how many scenes and how many scripts are the words setting, a diner, written, like a small ancestral shrine above the threshold? There are perhaps too many to count, for the diner in American cinema is a restaurant white space of a meaningless existence, our meaningless existence, against whose blankness we rage as we pour endless streams of sugar into a bitter black brew, plus a side of fries. And I'm really delighted to welcome Jan Whitaker, who is a consumer historian, which I'll have her explain, with an abiding interest in restaurant history, to talk a little bit about the American diner and how it plays into adolescence. Jan, are you there?
I'm here.
So let's start off with, you've written a book about department stores in 2011 called The World of Department Stores. But your restaurant blog, which is called restaurant-ing-through-history.com, is dedicated to the history of American restaurants. And that all
That's
falls
right.
under the umbrella of consumer historian?
Yeah, they're both consumer history and things that people are very familiar with. And there's even a connector, which is the tea room. That is an eating place in department stores, the classical sort of 1950s and earlier department stores. And so there is a connection there between eating places and department stores.
Oh, so you got through... You got two diners through tea rooms.
That's right, yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. That was one of my first interests. Really, I'm interested very broadly in all kinds of eating places that are the kinds that are businesses, you know, not school.
Right, not institutional.
Cafeterias, yeah, not right. institutional, right.
So the thing that I liked about American Graffiti, and I think about diners all the time, is I think they fill a unique place in American society, and which is why they're so great for movie settings, because anything can happen there. They're great for teenagers as well, and I mentioned that in the piece, and having been a teenager and hanging out at diners at 2 in the morning, you know, with your friends, because you have nothing else to do, and time's just going to keep on moving on, and you might as well have, you know, a burger. They occupy a unique space and offer a unique opportunity for human intercourse. And I was wondering what you thought about the role diners play and have played in American culture, maybe specifically in coming of age. It feels like...
Yeah, I agree with you. And the coffee is... Usually they are drinking coffee in the movies, by the way. It seems like they're not eating a big meal with gravy and that sort of thing. Maybe hamburger or, and a Coke or something like that. But, you know, you say coming of age, but when you think about it, though, it's mostly boys coming of age,
right,
in these kind of settings. It's not usually two girls. It could be a boy and a girl, but it's not normally two girls unless they are maybe flirting with a boy at the next booth or something like that.
Right. I'm indexing American Graffiti in my mind, and it does occur to me that the women who appear in the diner are either flirty waitresses or I think there's a scene where Ron Howard's character, Steve, is beset upon by two flirty school children. Well, I mean, like, you know, students, but they're mm-hmm. girls. But yeah, there's not a lot of... It's not a very feminine space, at least from a consumer standpoint.
Yeah, it's really a boy thing. And the thing about the diner, the classic diner, now I'm kind of talking about the ones that look like a railroad car or that sort of thing, that really was a male space historically through the 20th century. Now, those are really kind of working class, so they're unpretentious, noisy, a little bit rough, you know, the service, there's not a lot of decor,
the service is usually
that is kind
female.
Of the, you know, quintessential male environment mm-hmm. that they thrive in, and, you know, and it's almost sort of like no girls allowed kind of space where we don't want your fancy frills and that kind of thing. But yet, at the same time, you mentioned the waitress, and normally there are not waiters in these places, there are waitresses. And furthermore, in the movies, they are dressed in, like, the starched uniform, pastel color, with maybe the white apron and the cap on and the full regalia that, you know, that is also quaint now when you think about it, because if you have a woman server in a restaurant, she's not wearing those uniforms anymore. That's really from the past.
Right, and a diner sort of is... even if it's a modern diner, a bit of a callback to a time in the 50s where the whole world seemed to be operating in an unexamined hierarchy in a way that hierarchy is more fully examined today. I mean, the other thing that I was just thinking about, and as I was watching American Graffiti as well, is like there are no African Americans in the diner. And that makes sense set in 59.
They might not have been very friendly spaces for, you know, people of color.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting. Mel's Drive-In, which is a diner that is mentioned featured in American Graffiti.
Yeah.
And also Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, interestingly. They got sued for not allowing African Americans to have front of house jobs. So that was mm-hmm. a very complicated issue, which is totally glossed over. But I guess the question I have is, what do you think is particular about a diner that suggests it so well into movies and also just into the general teenagehood of American youth?
Well, you know, when you mention movie, I mean, I think there is something there that has to do with the logic of movies and a convenient kind of scene for them, too. I don't think it's just the content of the diner. The fact that if they're in a booth, which usually they are, sometimes they're sitting at the counter, but typically they're in a booth, it allows you to have two males looking at each other while they're talking. And if you really think about it, you know, males, they don't look at each other a lot like that eye-to-eye kind of thing. And, you know, so supposedly when two people are looking eye to eye and talking, they're being more honest or they're showing their emotions or something. So I think that it allows for that in the movies. And so that's part of the appeal. I think that it's almost a side thing that the viewer loves them so much that, you know, they've created a kind of icon that in the movies that isn't that easy to find in real life, actually.
Right.
You know?
Speaking about
So in a way, it's a slightly artificial. I mean, even calling a drive-in a diner, those are really historically two really different things.
Right. I guess the reason I felt comfortable calling the American Graffiti drive-in, a diner, is because there was a substantial eating area inside with what we would call...
Yeah, sometimes they did have the inside part, yeah. But the fact that you drove your car there really separates it a lot from the diner, which really came into being during the streetcar era. You know, so people didn't drive their cars there. They didn't even have parking lots, typically.
About the intersection between the movie world and real life, I also think it's interesting, though, that the booth, which does communicate, it gives an easy excuse for men to sit facing each other, looking eye to eye. You know, that is convenient for filming a scene and narrative, and, you know, that the narrative. But also in real life, I feel like there aren't that many areas where men can do that. And going to a diner is different than, say, going to a diner with a guy saying, hey, let's go grab a bite to eat at a diner. It's different than inviting him to a dinner, you know, like a more formal dinner.
Yeah. And see, the other thing about this kind of setting, whether it's, you know, call it diner, but coffee shop or whatever, is that it's a brightly lit space. So it does not suggest anything romantic, really.
Right.
And, you know, if we go back to, like, these supposed 50 scenes, even if they are, you know, made much later, the movies, and they're trying to recreate the 50s, then you're just not going to have two men flirting with each other in those movies, and you don't want any hint of it. So that kind of setting with the bright lights, the female server that they might flirt with and all, it's kind of real safely heterosexual, too.
Right. We had chatted a little before off the air, and you brought up the really interesting point that there's always been a diner of whatever time period it's been in. In the 50s and 60s, it was diners. To some extent today, still, even if it's mitigated by the fact that it's a Hollywood myth to some extent, but there's a diner fulfills a certain role. But you were going back in history.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about some of the other sort of... non-alcohol serving places of gathering that are loosely...
Well, see, yeah. The non-alcohol serving, that would be like the 20th century. Before that, there wasn't this big issue about... I mean, there were issues about drinking, but there wasn't that you must be 21 kind of thing. You could drink when at any age, basically. So in the, if we go way far in the past, you know, the early 19th century or something... then they do have alcohol. So such as the oyster cellar, for example, cellar, C-E-L-L-A-R, basement. Mm-hmm. They were usually in a basement. Those were places that were definitely hangouts, you might say. They were mostly males that went to them. The women that went there were disreputable, and you could spend a lot of time. The oysters didn't cost that much, so it did not involve spending a lot of money. And, you know, a lot of people who lived in cities, especially men, they lived in these rented rooms or something. They didn't have a home. They were called homeless, even though they did have an abode, you know, where they lived. But the places where they went to eat and drink, they were critically important because they were sort of like where you, almost where you live.
Right.
In a sense. Yeah. And so these would be young people, but of course, you know, that whole thing of teenager that we have now, well, it didn't really exist then because that's this kind of period between, you know, childhood and adulthood when you are somewhat free and everything. And that, you know, that didn't used to exist way back when. But so you had people, they might have been 16, 18 in these oyster cellars, but,
right.
You know, they weren't carefree teenagers. They were probably working like crazy, you know.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, you were talking about the coffee shops and the homeless men, and it's a little bit later, but I was thinking back to On the Bowery, the great Lionel Rogerson documentary, where those guys, you know, they were living in flop houses, I think, and they spent all their time in coffee shops that lined the Bowery back then.
Yeah.
So that was alive and well, you know, in the early, mid-20th century.
That's right, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and, you know, if... there's definitely always that kind of place, you know, which some people would call the third place, which is not work or home, but the place you can go and kind of hang out. And that's kind of what some of these restaurants were then. And still, you know, you can find some. I mean, the truck stop, I was thinking, is a little bit like that because it's open 24 hours. You know, you have working people, mostly men,
right.
coming in there, eating at all hours, and it's a real kind of lifesaver, kind of life preserver kind of place, you know, where you you really kind of refuel in many different senses of the word.
I think that's an interesting way to talk
about working people here. Whereas, you know, teenagers, though, I mean, they had earlier places, too, that they used to go. In the 50s, there was, like, this real, the malt shop, it was called, you know, where you got a milkshake or
right.
a malt. The soda shop, the soda fountain. The soda fountain goes way back as a place for young people to hang out, and that goes back to the late 19th century, really, and that includes women and girls.
To think about the diner, which I find so interesting, is so much of it, certainly in the film American Graffiti, also in the film Diner, happens late at night, in those twilight hours where there's no real good reason to be out except you're just hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is something a little, I wouldn't say illicit, but sort of driftless about it. And I'm sure that's also connected to why they are such male places.
But going back with that, too, a lot of restaurants, restaurant is almost too glamorous a word for some of these places, but lunchrooms or cafes or whatever, if we go back to, like, 1900, 1910 or something, I love to look at old photographs and I collect them, and I notice how often they would have, like, a pool table in an adjoining room or maybe the back of the restaurant. So it's, again, this theme of sort of hanging out. And, you know, you would spend hours and hours there. It wasn't just a place to sit at a table or a booth. They didn't usually have booths then. But,
right, they weren't as concerned as today.
You could play pool.
Yeah, today there's a lot of, you go to a place and you got to, you know, there's a couple of turns they have to make at the table, so there's a constant pressure to, after you're done eating, get up and leave. One of the great things about diners, and it sounds like those cafes and pool halls, is you can just hang out there all day and all night.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's quite different than the fast food restaurant, the chains, because there they actually engineer them to be sort of uncomfortable, the seating, so that you won't stay very long, because they want constant turnover. And this is sort of like going back to an era where they had not, some people wanted to, but they hadn't perfected that kind of thing. And they hadn't really thought it through that you got to get people out.
An earlier time. You know, Jen Whitaker, thank you so much for speaking with us. I hope you enjoy the rest of your night. You are up
in
Massachusetts. Are you watching the game?
No, I'm not watching.
Okay, well, have a good night.
I'm sorry to be disloyal to Massachusetts, but I'm not a fan.
Okay, have a great night.
Okay. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Bye. We'll be back after a short break with live rockabilly and the sounds of screaming rebel angels.
Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined, and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street in Napa and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
Hi, this is Chad Pagano, former Army sniper, host of the Wild Game Domain, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
Back to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour half hour. One of the best things, one of the best scenes of American Graffiti is at the dance, and there's a band there called Flash Cadillac and the Cadillac Kids, who are still actually going strong, although now called just Flash Cadillac. Well, I'd like to welcome Screamin' Rebel Angel to our show tonight. They perform Rockabilly, and we're going to hear a song. Their first song, Laura, is called
Sizzle.
Let's hear it.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Boom, 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 click, 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 stay high. Let's go. Jumping out wide, sizzle. Let's stay hot all night, sizzle. Let's cook it up just right, because you know I'm cooking, I cook it right. Come on, look out, my friend.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. It seems like you wrote that song just for this episode about diners.
Do you know what? I wrote it during my lunch break when I was a little hungry.
Is that true?
It is absolutely true. It's like, I'm hungry.
Was your hunger satisfied?
It was satisfied. It's like, do I write a song or go get lunch? I think I kind of chose somewhere in the middle.
Your sound, so the movie's written in 73, based in 59. What era would you kind of pinpoint your sound, or is that a silly question to ask and it's timeless?
We take a lot of influence from rockabilly, but we are by no means a traditional rockabilly band. We take a lot of influence from early rock and roll, early R&B, garage, punk rock, everything.
Yeah.
So just kind of put it together and just like a kind of an American sound.
The 50s were a good time for American music.
Yes, definitely.
The best time for American music?
Oh, I'm not sure if I would say the best time, but it was definitely an exciting, fun time.
Okay. Let's hear another one.
All right. You guys want to play? Let's play one on with you. Ready? I'm with you, oh, when I
voice begin to quiver. Baby, you deliver when I'm with you. When I'm with you. When I'm with you, when I'm with you, my toes start to tap, my fingers start to snap, my legs are fully wrapped, yeah, they're wrapped around you.
Screaming Rebel Angel. Amazing.
Thank you.
What? Tell us about where we can, where our listeners can hear you and where we can see you.
Because
they look amazing, dear radio listener. They are amazing. Go on.
Oh, I thank you. We have a website, www.screamingrebelangels.com. There's no G in screaming because I didn't realize when I named the band that would make it really complicated. Facebook.
It sounds really good. Screaming Rebel Angels is less cool.
The next time we're playing in New York will be Saturday, March 7th at someplace on Wall Street, and I just forgot the name of it.
So just go to Wall Street and start yelling.
Just go around there. I think it's on Stone Street. I don't know. Something. We'll be going on tour. We'll be hitting the Midwest, the South.
Do you guys play a lot of dances, or do you ever play dances, or do you play mostly concerts with dancing or no dancing?
What's really fun about the music that we play is that we fit into like rock and roll shows. So we've done everything from play Webster Hall, the Grand Ballroom, and Bowery Ballroom to playing like small VFWs, which is a whole bunch of people like dancing around and playing for hours there. So it's good. This type of music, everybody loves it, and it kind of hits on different levels.
And it makes you want to dance, for
definitely.
Sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, do you guys want to give... Well, actually, first, can you introduce a band?
Sure.
And then we'll...
Well, we have on upright bass, Danger Dan. Dan Vina.
Dan.
Dan. Or Dan. Or just Dan.
Or just Dan.
Or just Dan. On drums, we have Ed Kozak playing the snare. Hi, Ed.
How's it going, guys?
What's up? And we have Bobo on lead guitar. If you couldn't tell me yelling at Bobo, play faster. Sharing all of it. And I am Laura Rebel Angel.
Guys, can I have some music to take us out on?
Sure. Thank you for having us.
Oh, thanks for coming.
Thanks for the pizza.
You just wait.
Oh, I'm waiting for the beer, too.
Well, that's our show tonight on the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Jan Whitaker, Screaming Rebel Angel, and of course, as always, our beautiful engineer, Liz Smith. That's it. Enjoy the game, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for
for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.